Welcome to the Geriatric Journal Club, featuring practical discussions on the front line of PALTC issues that you wrestle with every day. References for this podcast and links to previous recordings can be found at paltc.org/journalclub. Support for this podcast is brought to you by U.S. Post Acute Care.
It is my great pleasure today to introduce the two people I didn't even know 6 months ago and now have just enormous respect for. They're both from CSU. They've been working on COVID with us, Greg Ebel and Nicole Earhart. And I saw Greg, I don't know if Nicole is on, but they are going to talk to us today about testing and all things COVID. I've got more questions even than I sent them, and I hope you guys have some questions as well. And Greg, I'll turn it over to you because I don't see Nicole, although she may be on. It's all yours.
She's on.
Oh, good.
Hi, everyone. I'll let Greg start there.
Yeah, so hi. Thanks so much for the invitation, Greg. And we were just asked to come and talk about different tests and what they do and what they don't do. And so today we just have put together a few slides to kind of help me work my way through this and Nicole also to work our way through it. So I'll share my screen in a sec, but I first just want to start by thanking you all for what you're doing and also to apologize in advance if some of this stuff seems really kind of rudimentary and basic. I don't know too much about what everybody's background is, and so please, I don't mean to be patronizing in any way, just trying to be useful. I figured to start by talking about assays that we use to detect virus infection, and so this is an active infection, something that's happening at a time. It's something that you would want to know about a patient or a resident or a person before they get on an airplane or something, and so. There are three general flavors of these that are being used in the field, depending on what kind of question you're asking and what the purpose is. They're used for different things. So the first I want to start off. So I'll start off just by looking at this kind of diagram of a coronavirus right here. So I'm assuming that you all can see this, and the virus has an envelope, which is this kind of greenish thing here that kind of circles, it's the circle part of it, and that comes from a host cell, and then embedded in that are virus proteins, which are the red things and the orangish things and the yellow stuff there, and that all kind of sticks in a host cell membrane. On the inside is the viral RNA, and so there are assays that detect different parts of the virus. The first ones that I'm going to tell you about detect viral RNA, which is this blue stuff, and you can see that it's bound up in these other little proteins, which are the blue blobs that are stuck on it. Those are called nucleoproteins. So to detect viral RNA, generally we use a test called quantitative real-time reverse transcription polymerase chain reaction. That's because the virus genome in the case of SARS coronavirus 2 is made of RNA. We have DNA. This group of viruses have RNA. So this is a technology that amplifies the viral RNA by a series of chemical reactions that I can tell you about in detail if you're interested. Generally, it's quite sensitive, and that's why it's used extensively in diagnostic labs and in research labs and in the field, is that you can amplify even one single copy of the viral RNA into tens or hundreds of thousands of copies over the course of a few hours, and that makes it quite easy to detect. When you find RNA in a sample, that generally means that that's someone who's infected, or they were very, very, very recently infected. RNA tends to go away when someone is no longer infected and so fairly quickly. Because the technique is so sensitive and because there's this amplification step, we sometimes are concerned with false positives. So that can happen for a lot of reasons. Sometimes there's just weird stuff that happens in the reaction that nobody really knows, you know, what it is. Other times, because we're amplifying the molecule so much from RNA, which is very unstable, to DNA, which is highly stable, it's easy to contaminate a lab. And so that's something that we worry about. We also are concerned somewhat about negatives. Those false negatives, those tend to occur when samples haven't been handled correctly because, as I mentioned, RNA is not a stable molecule. We see persistent positives by this type of test. And one of the nice things about it is that you can make many, many, many different tests to detect the same RNA molecule because you can design the assay to target different regions of what's a fairly large RNA molecule that these viruses have. Okay. The other type of assay is looks for virus antigen. And these antigens are these proteins that I pointed out earlier that compose the body of the virus, if you will. Again, a positive signal on an antigen test indicates an active infection. The technologies that are used to detect them are generally rely on antibodies, and the antibodies can be designed to recognize this type of molecule and then be detected elsewhere down on a strip. But I'll show you how those tests work in a minute. In general, these are compared to the molecular diagnostics that I told you about up here, are relatively insensitive. We would be very, very surprised if something like this had the ability in a typically clinically relevant setting to detect a single molecule. A strength of this is that protein is relatively stable compared with RNA. And so if we have a problem with a cold chain or something, you know, we worry a little bit less about the sample quality. But we worry more about false negatives, right? Because that lack of sensitivity might mean that there's someone who has a fairly low level infection, but they're still infected. And maybe tomorrow they'll be shedding virus like crazy. They just aren't right now. I have to move everybody's heads again so I can read what's down there. And sometimes the sensitivity can be improved because sometimes virus proteins are secreted from infected cells, and that makes them relatively easier to detect. A third kind of class of virus detection assays is virus culture. And so that's something that's typically reserved for research labs or large kind of centralized surveillance type labs. And what you would do with that is you take a sample from a patient or wherever, and you bring it into the lab and you try to infect cells with it. And then if you see that there's an infection there, then the person was infected. And the nice thing about that is that it's really clear if someone's infected by that. If you have a positive on virus culture, you know pretty darn well that that person's positive. Virus can be unstable though, and so there you could miss it if you have problems with a cold chain, for example. Okay, so I will move on, if that's okay with everybody, to the next slide. I think I only have 8 or 9 or so, and we'll move through them fairly quickly so that we have plenty of time to discuss afterwards. Just for everyone's information, I don't think this is going to be news to any of you. Most commercial tests for SARS coronavirus 2 use quantitative real-time polymerase chain reaction, QRT-PCR. That is due to the sensitivity, and it's a relatively kind of commercializable, easy way to do things. And so in the lab at CSU, where we are doing our CLIA certified testing, we're using a thermodiagnostics that's based on QRT-PCR. And so that's what you see here. There's a couple of different ways that the assay can work, which are diagrammed over here. All of the tests that are used in these commercial assays have a DNA probe-based real-time PCR. And so what this gives you, in addition to a positive or negative, is a quantitative estimate of how much viral RNA is in a given sample. So the way that that works is you have, this is for DNA, but just pretend like it's RNA and we reverse transcribed it and now we have DNA. You have primers that stick to this and they amplify it. And then as they come, as the temperature in the reaction, heats up, there are these probes that stick onto the single-stranded RNA. And then when the polymerase comes along, there's a little fluorescent molecule that's stuck onto it, and the polymerase kicks that molecule off and it goes into solution where it can be detected. And so then what you end up with down here is a rise in the fluorescence in a given sample as the cycles go on through the reaction. And so depending on, I have to move everybody's heads again, how quickly you see the signal come up, this would mean that there's more virus in the sample and there would be less virus. This is like a standard curve. So you'd predict that there would be a sample that would kind of come along here and then shoot up right around here. And then based on these standards, you'd be able to say, well, there was about 20 million copies of the viral RNA. So there are some limitations to this, some of which I've told you about before, but this isn't very fast. It's not very cheap. And you know, you have to have lots of lab controls and process controls to make it be reliable. There are some very exciting new methods. LAMP is one of them. That's a loop-mediated isothermal amplification reaction, which is a lot faster and it's a lot cheaper. And so if you've read about some of the spit tests that cost something like $5 a sample, that's kind of what we're talking about for that. And those are faster and cheaper. Okay. So that's the commercial QRT-PCR tests. Antigen tests that are now becoming commercially available look more like this. I mentioned that these are antibody-based tests, and there's a couple that have been commercialized. And this one is from Abbott, and it's now, I think, being rolled out. The way that these things work is that you take a sample and you put it on here, and this red thing can represent the virus. So the virus, as it floats along this strip of paper, and this is very much like a pregnancy test, it binds to this antibody that has either a piece of colloidal gold or an enzyme of some kind that's stuck to the end of it and continues to float up here. Now we're down here. Continues to float up here. And then if this thing is stuck here, it will also bind to the other antibody, which has the same specificity as this antibody. And so you have a collection of these colloidal golds or enzymes or whatever stuck at this band. And then the extra antibodies are detected up here. And that tells you that the test worked. And then you have this test line, which will turn positive if enough of these antibodies have picked up antigen and then are stuck there at the same spot. Okay, so these also are fast. You can typically get results in about, I don't know, 5, 10, 20 minutes, something like that. They can be done at the bedside. I put "at the bedside" in quotes because I don't really know when you all are doing these tests in real life. If you're actually sitting there next to somebody's bed, I imagine you probably aren't. One of the shortcomings of them currently is that we don't really know how well they work in healthy individuals. There's also a lot of exciting progress in this area, and new non kind of flow-based assays are coming online probably fairly soon, but that's pretty exciting too.
I just had a comment I wanted to add that I think it's important to realize where these tests can go wrong, and Greg's already alluded to a lot of this, but for PCR tests, because RNA is so fragile, if the samples aren't kept cold, that's where you can begin to have incorrect test results. That's a big one. And then for antigen, and there's a number of other ways, but just remember that if you're getting results that aren't fitting with what you believe is happening in the patient, that there are ways in which these can be faulty, every single one, even RT-PCR, which is the gold standard. And I think somebody asked the question in the chat about, are false positive and negative rates calculated based on a gold standard using virus culture? And I wondered if you could comment on that, because you're about to talk about virus culture here. Greg, do you know what the published false negative and false positive rates are based on?
No.
Because I don't think it's virus culture.
I don't think it is. I think it's, well, so the real answer is I don't know, but I would imagine that I'm just thinking where the samples likely came from in the beginning, and that probably is someone who's, you know, sick as all get out, and there's a sample and the sample comes back negative for SARS, and then 2 days later it comes back positive. And so then you have this series of samples that gets used, but I don't really know. I'm not really involved in generating that type of data, but I'm almost sure that it's not based on culture. That would be very strong.
I agree with that. And then one other question relative to PCR is, Dr. Ebert asked, is there a specific CT value that you use as a cutoff for a positive test?
Yeah.
That's a good question.
Yeah, it's a great question. So there's a lot of ways to do that, but typically, yes. In my lab, where we do some surveillance testing for SARS-CoV-2, we use like a very liberal cutoff of 38 on an N1 QRT PCR. And so that means that we're going to find false positives because we've just said 38 is what we want to pay attention to. What we then do is test by two different primer sets that also are targeted to the SARS-CoV-2 genome. And when we see that all three of those are positive by that cutoff of 38 or so, those are almost always going to be confirmed by some other confirmatory test. As the CT value goes down, which means that the viral RNA level is going up, the individual predictive value of any one of those tests also goes up, right? So the hotter the signal, the more likely it is that it's not a false positive. Although those tests that are right around the edge, you just never really know if you don't confirm it. Did you not confirm it because you've now frozen and thawed the sample one time? Or were you just catching the very, very, very beginning or the very, very, very end of an infection? And because it's N1, which because of the way the virus replicates, that's an extremely, extremely sensitive target. Interpreting those really borderline things is quite difficult. The commercial assays tend to have software that is sold along with the system that makes the call for you. But we're a research lab, so we don't have that kind of stuff. Okay?
Yep, thanks, Greg.
Yeah. I just wanted to mention that there are also, you know, more kind of biological methods for detecting virus. And was it done either by plaque assay here, which is where you take a sample and you make a bunch of dilutions of it, and then you put it onto a plate that's growing cells. Here's a microscope looking at the cells. And then you wait some number of time and then you do a live dead stain for the cells. And then you can look at these holes, and these white spots are holes in the monolayer. And the reason that there are holes in the monolayer is that a virus established an infection there and it's been killing these cells. Another way that you can do it is just to look at the bulk culture without doing a plaque assay. And you can start to see the cells in the dish start to die and they round up and they fall off. And you can kind of see that happening here. This would be an uninfected sample. And then over here, you'd see a sample where, these cells are clearly undergoing pretty severe cytopathic effects. And this is very typical of what CPE, which is what we call this in the field, looks like. And this is like what you need to do to detect live virus. And so how does this come into practice? Nicole, do you want to kind of take over here for a little bit?
You can go ahead because I have a puppy that's demanding attention and whining, and I think he's going to be distracted.
Okay, cool.
So keep going. Thanks, Greg.
All right. So it can be really nice when you have different types of data that you can then combine to look at what's going on in individual patients. And so this is an example from the study that Nicole and I and Greg Gom have been doing now for quite some number of months. And this is just some sample data just to kind of show you the range of things that we see. The N1 copy, so this is QRT-PCR data here, and this is a log scale, so this is like 100, 1,000, 10,000, 100,000, a million, 100 millions up to, I don't know, maybe billions up here, I don't know. In the orange, you have number of N1 copies, and then in red, you have PFU, so that's plaque-forming unit. So here we're comparing molecular to culture-based diagnostics, if you will. These aren't really diagnostics, these are research samples, but it can be quite nice to have multiple types of data to look at the same samples. And so here's a sample where we have high RNA, high virus, and then the next week we have slightly lower RNA and no infectious virus. This person we would still count as infected, we just can't detect infectious virus. The limit of detection of all of these assays also varies quite a bit. So these are just an example of the different patterns that we've seen by applying these types of tests. In our studies, we haven't really used antigen detection tests. I think those are quite promising and they'll be important in the future, but we haven't used them yet. Okay, so moving on to serological assays, there are a lot of different ways that we detect past infection. And this is a
Can I ask a question about the FLAC test?
About the which test?
The FLAC test.
The one you
showed us the three slides. Is that specific for coronavirus or will any virus that is destroying those cells do that?
We use exactly the same kind of a test to look for Zika virus and West Nile virus. And sometimes if you do a plaque assay like we've done on samples that come from our study, if there's influenza there, you'll get plaques from that too. I wouldn't say any virus because there are viruses that don't infect the types of cells that we use to do these assays. But this does not in itself tell us that this is SARS coronavirus 2. We know that these are SARS-CoV-2 because we have RNA data to go along with it.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
And then there's another question, which I think is really a great question also. Will mRNA vaccination affect the accuracy of our swab testing, and will antigen tests be affected more than PCR?
I don't think so. I don't think an mRNA vaccine would have an impact, because that would be very unlikely to produce virus that would be capable to spread beyond the site of infection. Now, I don't know exactly what the constructs are that are being used for mRNA vaccination, and I should, but typically the design of an mRNA vaccine is that it's given at a skin-based or intramuscular site. I don't know what the specifics are for this vaccine. And they induce production in your cells of virus proteins that induce an immune response, but typically those would not produce virus that would be able to spread systemically and show up in the swabs.
Yeah, and plus it's not the entire genome, right? So once we know what even if there was a nasal vaccine, once we know what mRNA segment they're using or whatever they're using, then we would test for whatever is the rest of the genome or another spot in the genome.
Yeah.
PCR. Yeah.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And the transcript that's used mostly for diagnostics wouldn't be impacted in any way. It's like a non-structural coding sequence of the virus. So it codes for a protein that's involved in RNA replication in some way.
Managing your patient's needs across multiple specialties is increasingly important, but also an increasingly challenging task. U.S. Post-Acute Care now offers clinical staffing solutions not only for primary care medicine, but also for behavioral health, chronic care management, and telehealth, bringing you a more comprehensive solution for your patients and your facilities. Now more than ever, your patients need you in so many ways. Let U.S. Post-Acute Care help you deliver more complete, quality care. For more information, visit us at uspostacutecare.com.
I just want to point out that when an individual is infected by a virus, there are these different stages of the immune system, immune activation that occur. And the easiest and best way to determine whether someone has a history of infection is to look at antibodies, which are shown down here. This is the B cell antibody response. And most often we're detecting IgM or IgG, which are present, which are circulating in blood, which is pretty easy to get. And then IgA, we don't really test for as often. That can be in circulation. Also, we expect to find it in the mucosa. So how do we do this? I just want to see if I didn't, if I put any other notes on here. No, I didn't. Okay, so there are lots of, as with viral RNA, there are a lot of different assays that are capable of detecting antibodies, and there are a couple of these that have been commercialized. Some are better than others, but these also are based on kind of the lateral flow types of assays. There's a lot of different ways of detecting it. The only difference with the lateral flow type assay for antibodies is that you have the antibodies come along, and then there's an antigen it's present that this person's antibody sticks onto, and then there's another antibody that comes onto that and sticks onto that. So there are commercial tests that are produced by this company called Celex and Abbott. There are also ELISA-based methods. So these are things that are used in research labs and maybe also in diagnostic labs. I don't really know the extent that they're used in like actual clinical diagnostic labs, but it's a very common tool to measure antibodies, where you take an antigen and you stick it onto the bottom of one of these little wells here, and then you put somebody's serum on top, and if they have an antibody that sticks to that, then the antibody sticks, and then you label it with something, or you put a secondary antibody in that recognizes this antibody, and then you develop the whole thing with an enzyme that if there's sticking antibodies in there, turns it blue, and that's positive, and if not, then it stays white or yellow or whatever the color is. Also, there are culture-based methods for measuring antibodies. these again are fairly kind of biological, in that it's really straightforward. What you do is you take a person's serum and you mix it up with virus and you incubate it for like a half hour or an hour. And then you do a plaque assay with that stuff. And if you know how much virus should be in there, then you can say, well, I expect there to be 100 plaques, and this looks like about 100 plaques. And here's somebody who we mixed their serum and it didn't make any plaques, or there was only one. So this person's serum was able to neutralize the infectivity of this virus. And that's taken really as kind of a gold standard for, has the person have antibodies against SARS coronavirus. I think that's about all that I'm going to say about that. This is some other data from the project that we've done, kind of showing you how this fits in with the rest of the data that we are that we've collected. And again, we have N1 copies per swab. So this is molecular evidence of infection. And so here's somebody who was infected on this week of observation. And then we drew blood here, and they had, their serum was able to neutralize the virus at a dilution of about 1 to 300 or 1 to 400. And then many weeks later, we took a second sample and it did also. Same kind of story over here. Here's an example down here of two individuals who had a positive RNA signal for 1, 2, 3 weeks. This person also had 1, 2, 3 weeks. And then some number of weeks later, we sampled their blood and tested its ability to neutralize the virus. This person, after 3 weeks since they cleared virus, or maybe that's only two, I can't quite tell, was really poorly able to neutralize the virus. And only after many months was there an appreciable neutralization ability. The reason I point this out is that it doesn't necessarily mean if you've had infection for a long time that you're gonna make a rip-roaring antibody. That's kind of the case over here. We have a lot of work to do with this yet, but I thought it was maybe interesting to see kind of how you can put this type of information together and, you know, hopefully someday learn something about the biology of the virus in different people. Those are all the slides that I had. Nicole, do you want to chime in here? Let me stop sharing my screen.
Yeah, there are a few questions in the chat that probably would be worthwhile discussing. So let's see. So following up on the vaccine thing. So since mRNA vaccines are producing spike proteins, it won't affect PCR, but could it alter what you see with antigen testing? And so I think the mRNA vaccines are not producing spike proteins. Some of them are based upon spike proteins. And so would that alter what you see with antigen testing? That's the question. And then a follow-up question was, wouldn't it also depend if the vaccine prevents infection or prevents disease?
Yeah. So let's just go take the second one first. It would matter. Again, I think that you would expect that there would be enough time between vaccination and infection that you wouldn't really see an interference. The interference would be if the vaccination worked, then the person wouldn't get infected. But if it's like an IM or a sub-Q vaccine, then you wouldn't expect, if you're doing a nasal swab or a spit test, that would have really any impact. That's just too far away from where the vaccine's being given. What was the other question? I feel like maybe I'm missing something.
No, I think you got it. They're asking.
That was my mistake. My understanding of the Moderna vaccine was that it was getting ribosomal production of spike proteins, which is what the antigen tests that we're using are looking for. So I may have been confusing that.
Yeah, but I still think that you wouldn't have, there wouldn't, the sample, the compartment would be so different that I don't think it would be. And then the Abbott rapid diagnostic is based on a nucleoprotein. Okay. So I think it'll be okay.
Okay.
Yeah. I think where the water might get muddy is if there are nasal vaccines, you know, where they're squirting it up your nose and then you're testing somebody shortly after that. Right. That then we need to know, like, what component of the virus have we shot in there to create the immune response? And, you know, is that going to cross react with the antigen test? So there's where I think we might, I don't know, is that correct, Greg? Would you agree?
I think it could be. I just think, you know, any kind of diagnostic algorithm is going to have to take into account what the vaccine strategy is in a given area when that rolls out. I'm pretty confident that those kinds of, you know, strategies for determining the burden of infection can do that, can take into account what are the vaccines that are out there and how do we deal with that.
So I didn't cut this off at 1 o'clock because it's so important, but I will open it up for questions in the chat line or unmute yourself. Now is the time to ask.
Hi, this is Renee Marquardt. I have a question. Am I off mute?
You are, Renee. You're just fine.
Okay, great. Sorry, and I'm off camera right now because I'm walking around trying to get some food before my next meeting. But so I missed a key sentence you said when you were talking about the sensitivity of the PCR tests and about false positives. And I've been trying to sort out. I'm with CDHS, and we have 20 facilities that were managing COVID and doing a lot of testing, and we're trying to sort out inconclusive. And could you say again how a false positive can be produced on a PCR other than contamination?
Yeah. Well, so for the amplification plot on a real-time machine, sometimes you can get in a well, you can just get probe hydrolysis that results in release of the fluorophore from the probe. And those can kind of sneak up and you can start to detect them. And I don't really know why they're there. Also, sometimes you can get just kind of weird random binding. And again, it's just these weird things that I don't think there's a great explanation of how or why they happen. I mean, maybe there is out there, but typically, not always, typically software that goes with the sort of test systems has a good way of pulling those things out and kind of saying, well, this looks like sort of just a late rising kind of, the curve looks different. And if once you look at enough of these curves, you just kind of know that looks funny.
Okay.
The other way that they can be, you know, quote unquote false positives is that you're just catching somebody at the very, very beginning or the very, very end.
Yeah.
Infection. And that just means that you're never going to be able to repeat it because they just lost your infection today, or you miss it some other way. So I think, but those
not really a false positive.
Exactly what you mean? Those inconclusives are going as well.
So and with the inconclusives, and you know, and I don't know the detailed mechanisms of the test, but so my what I'm told is that it's like one of the two signals came out positive, and I'm wondering, can that be for the reason you just explained for a false positive? The hydrolyzing and the random attachment and things like that.
That's
different than what I was told. I was told that it means that they must have detected some virus, or it wouldn't have been a positive signal in even one of the two.
Yes, that also is correct, right? And those are probably that's probably the main way that you get inconclusive. And that also is kind of a flavor of what I was saying about right at the beginning or right at the end.
Yeah.
So the way that SARS-CoV-2 replicates, the N1 transcript is produced in a very high abundance within cells. I didn't really talk about that at the beginning. So that's the reason that N1 is such a sensitive and fairly good target, is that you're not just detecting the RNA that's stuck into the virus particles that are floating around, but if cells are sloughing off, and a lot of times you get a lot of extra cells when you're in a swab, you can amplify the RNA that's not only in the particle, but all the transcription.
Yeah.
Cells,
right.
So, yeah.
Yeah, I guess I'm more concerned about sorting out though when it's not actually due to real viral RNA, and it sounds like there is a possibility of that, which I didn't realize before now.
Yeah, you can usually screen those out though. I think you can usually get rid of those.
So the lab by looking at what the curve be getting rid of those. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Got it. Okay. Thank you. So are you aware of any other reasons for inconclusive?
No. Other than, I mean, the only other comment that I'll make is that You know, we deal with inconclusives, not so much in my lab, but in the lab that we work with on our very kind of much larger state surveillance project. And what I can tell you is that when we get inconclusives there, what we always do is, you know, run it over again with everything all over again. And if it's inconclusive today and we do it again this afternoon, it's pretty much always inconclusive the second time. If we go back to the sample and redo everything, mm-hmm. it's almost always remains inconclusive, or else when it's not still inconclusive, it goes negative. So that to me points to that kind of just like weird voodoo that sometimes happens in chemical reactions.
Okay, thank you.
There's a question in the chat line, Greg. Do you test stool for SARS-CoV-2? If so, do you know the time course of fecal virus shedding? And I know at CSU, this should be close to home because I think that's how they found a couple of the sororities and fraternities up there.
Yeah, so in my lab, we are not, but we at CSU are, yes. And that's being used to sample wastewater from manholes that are outside of the dorms and probably the fraternities and sororities too. And just this week, we've detected infection in a couple of the dorms, and the dorms had to go into quarantine and everybody there got tested. The time course of shedding from feces typically precedes shedding from the nasopharynx and in the saliva. So that's seen as a fairly good early warning way to test. We don't really do that clinically in our, that's just not a sample that we're gonna get and that I'm gonna work with. But there are people who are doing that.
Any other questions?
Just finishing up on that question on testing stool. You said that enterocytes, infected enterocytes, will shed earlier than ethmoidal cells shedding virus and, you know, nasal shedding of virus. And that's really very interesting. How long will feces virus shedding go on for? Will it, let's say a person who's quarantined for 2 weeks continue shedding virus in their stool afterwards?
So I don't know the answer to that question, but I would suspect based on lots of other viruses of this type that kind of get into the GI tract and the kidneys and so forth, that you might see shedding of RNA in, you know, excretion of RNA for quite a long time. But I don't know that exactly. I don't know that anybody's been able yet to culture SARS out of stool.
Thank you.
Renee, go ahead.
Yeah, hi, I had another wastewater question, so maybe I need to find my answers elsewhere, but if you happen to know, I'm wondering if you know the sensitivity, like how many people we need to be infected, because I know it's, you know, being used in settings with sort of low risk populations, mass housing and things like that, but sometimes it's being discussed for, you know, higher risk settings like, you know, nursing facilities where it would have to be like detecting, you know, the first person infected to be really very useful. We're not looking for when 10% of the population is already infected.
Yeah, the only data that I know about that is from, again, the CSU dorms that were shut down on the basis of a positive signal in the wastewater. And so in that case, there were approximately 900 residents in the dorm, and they shut them down and swabbed everybody. And 1%, so 9 individuals were positive. So would one of them have been able to trigger it? Was virus from one the trigger? I don't know, but in that case, it was 9 and 9.
That's pretty sensitive. Okay, thanks.
Yeah, one more question, if I may, Greg, before we finish.
Please, yeah. Here.
What is your understanding of super shedders? as there are some major epidemiological hypotheses about how COVID-19 infection differs from the influenza model, and it focuses on these super shedders. What is your understanding of that?
What we know from our data is that there are a relatively small number of individuals who have very extremely high levels of infection. If you want, in a second, I'll just answer the question, and then if you want to hang on, I can show you what I'm talking about. And what we think is that we detect a lot of positive RNA, but the people who are probably shedding like crazy is probably pretty small. So that's kind of the basis of what I'm going to say, is that I think that probably is likely to be pretty darn important. In addition to that, the study that's been going on at the University of Illinois, where they're testing all of their students and faculty twice a week by a spit test, is showing kind of what I think a lot of us intuitively understood before this, which is that most of the transmission is due to these really large social gatherings, which to me also points toward, you know, there being a relatively small number of people who are transmitting quite efficiently and the rest of them are not. So.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, good. And someone says, this is what I understand as well. That's wonderful. Thank you. So I can show you, if you would like, I can try to share my screen again.
Yes.
Yep. Yes.
So what you're looking at here are different molecular primer probe sets. So this is N1, like I said. N is transcribed like crazy, so it's really a good detection. And this is N1 copies per swab and N2 copies per swab. And then E is not, so this is N1 and E, and then N2 versus E. So the N-based assays are more sensitive. But then over here, we're showing infectious virus against each of these things. And so there's a few people here. So 10 to the fifth, 10 to the sixth, that's per swab about, you know, a million plaque-forming units. And that's somebody who's just walking around healthy, apparently, on their way to work at a nursing home or another skilled nursing facility, whereas a lot of these other things, so we kind of focus on these because I think that there's just no way that this person's not snotting out tons of virus and contributing significantly to transmission, whereas a lot of these people down here are really not. You know, these are people who, they have a positive N1, but we are unable to detect infectious virus. So as I said, there's a lot of reasons for that, but I think the message should be that a fairly small number of these people are contributing disproportionately to transmission. And some of our molecular epidemiological studies where we sequence virus from all these people are, I think, kind of backing us up on that. But really, probably there's just a few people who are spreading to everybody. Okay, I'll stop my share. I saw that there was a raised hand. Was there a raised hand?
Anybody else?
Maybe just one more.
Sure.
What is your thoughts about reinfection? And have you seen any evidence of that?
We have not in our studies yet seen any evidence of reinfection. There's one good example of somebody who was infected and was in the hospital and clearly had COVID-19 and then got better and then got sick again with COVID-19, and it was a different virus and was also quite ill and was back in the hospital with a different, I've heard of one of those in the literature. There may be more, but there was one that sort of made a splash a few weeks back.
There is a question, Galaxy S9, you're gonna have to explain this. How likely is a need for a booster at this point? I'm not sure I understand the question since we don't have the vaccine yet. I'm not sure what the booster is.
Vaccine. Yeah, I would be surprised if it was a single inoculation vaccine. I would be surprised about that, but I don't know. The data that I saw was a prime boost, I think. I think it was a prime boost. Anybody read those papers?
Yeah, I've only seen one vaccine that's gotten to phase 3 that didn't require a second or a booster.
Yeah, I think that's the Johnson & Johnson that doesn't need a booster, if I'm not mistaken.
And is that a live attenuated vaccine?
I believe so.
I think it's based on it's based on another virus vector. So I think it's maybe an adenovirus vector spike expressed or something like that. I didn't prep for vaccine questions. Sorry.
Yeah.
You can probably tell that we do lots of PCR and lots of virus detection and less antibody, but some, and then nothing with vaccines in my lab.
We'll get there.
Okay. Someday.
Okay. Any other questions? If not, just a huge thanks to both of you, especially to Greg. Thank you for the presentation. If you guys have more questions, feel free to shoot them to me. I talk to Greg and Nicole probably more frequently than they want to hear from me. But
it's great. It's always great to talk to you. And really, I'm easy to find. I'm easy to get in touch with. Yeah. So.
Okay.
Well, Greg, I want to thank you also on behalf of Vivage for putting this call together, and it was very informative. I think I could have saved the phone call to you this morning if I would have known all this I learned today. So thank you so much for everybody joining the call.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.
Bye. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Thanks. Bye.
Support for this podcast is brought to you by U.S. Post-Acute Care.